Hello and welcome to the Dancecast, where I explore dance as an art form, traveling to non-traditional places and with non-traditional doers. I'm your host and my name is Silva Lakkonen. Welcome to Dancecast episode 24. It was one of those moments when I interviewed this next person. One of those moments that you sort of dream of for a quite while, to ask questions and talk to the person that has influenced you a lot in your professional field. In my case, this person has influenced me in my professional field. And I was so giddy to when thinking about the questions and when starting the interview. And it was just such a pleasure to get to know more of his work and more of the ways of him thinking about his work. And of course, this person is Adam Benjamin. So I took his summer intensive school last summer at Plymouth in the UK. And it was just a really great to actually meet him. I had purchased his book a long time ago, Making an Entrance. If you need a really good practical book, go and buy that. Had always sort of idolized his work and him from far away. So it was great to actually have that person to come alive and be not as good, but actually even better in person than you imagined. So here's the little introduction of Adam to people who might not know. He's a freelance dance artist. He was joint founder and artistic director of Kendugo Dance Company and has choreographed for community groups and professional companies around the world. In South Africa, shortly after the dismantling of apartheid, he founded the award-winning Zawaragano Dance Company. He will say it much better in the episode. The first South African dance company integrated on both racial and disability lines. Recent works include The Birth of Memory for Exim Dance Company in the UK and Open State for Company Kyo in Japan. Adam has received numerous awards, including a London Time Out Performance Award, the Sainsbury's Award for Education, and a Prudential Award with Kendugo. He has been an associate artist at The Place, a Wingate Scholar, a Rain Choreographic Fellow, and recipient of an Arts Council International Artist Fellowship. He was awarded a National Teaching Fellowship in 2013 while a lecturer at Plymouth University and was named a changemaker by the South Bank Centre in 2015. Alongside his dance work, Adam is a Tai Chi teacher based in the Tamar Valley. Here's the episode. I truly hope you enjoy it. Oh, I just remembered. And actually, listen to the very end, listen after the song, and there is a little addition to my last question that Adam had thought about. And so, in order to find out what it was, remember to listen all the way through. I hope you enjoy it. Well, I'm so happy you're taking some time to talk with me. You know, you're definitely my idol that I looked up to when going to college. So this is like a huge moment for me. But I want to learn more about you. How did you start dancing? I know we talked a little bit about that over the summer. But how did you end up start dancing?
Well, I think often that question is asked. And I think the reality is the question really is, how do you stop? Why did you stop dancing? Because I think, you know,
there's a point where dance as a kid.
And then, yeah. And I think in some ways, had that not happened, I would have been dancing much earlier. My career path would have been very different, but I was stopped dancing because of the very negative kind of impression that I gained off the people that were around me when I was young. So when I was at school at that time in the 60s, 70s, you know, we did dance. Dance was part of the junior school program, and that was great. Lots of creative stuff there. And then I went to my secondary school, so kind of age around 12. And dance was also placed within PE, within physical education, and it was taught by our PE instructors, our rugby teachers, and our, you know. And they did it because they had to do it. And I have this kind of branded on my mind. I have this moment where we were doing a creative dance session in part of our PE kind of curriculum. And I was lost in the music and doing my thing. And I can remember opening my eyes, and I'll never forget this. My rugby instructor, who was kind of leading this session, was stood there with his arms folded across his muscular chest, with his muscles bulging out of his shorts, and he was just looking at me with what can only be described as contempt. And I realized in that moment that were I to have a life in this, it was the biggest secondary school in London at the time. It's not so big now, but back then it was a big thing. It was 2,200 kids.
Wow.
And I just realized that if I was going to survive in that school, I better stop doing that floating.
Oh my God. I just want to come and give that Adam a hug right now. That's terrible image.
Yeah. Yeah. But anything around, you know, you really wanted to keep your head down in that environment because, you know, although it wasn't a bad school compared to many of the schools at that time, but you didn't want to let people know that you were interested in dancing because that was just, it was really just an invitation for, you know, for a very sad life as a young boy. So I have to kind of confess to my own cowardice. You know, I was no Billy Elliot. And I just knuckled down and I played sport. And I did that for quite a while, sports and athletics. And then around the age of, no, then I, in my kind of, when I finished school, I went to America. I went traveling in the States and I saw Pelobolas in 1976. And I began to meet one or two people who were dancers. But even then I kind of, you know, it was too big a leap for me. And instead I got very interested in, around age 20, I found Tai Chi. And then from that, I went into martial arts. And after a while, I realized that all the kind of the teachers that I really respected in the martial arts weren't talking about fighting. They were talking about dancing. They were talking about space and distance and timing and contact and connection and it was like a light bulb came on. I thought, oh, what I really am interested in is that stuff, the stuff about moving in time and space and, you know, all of that. But by then I was kind of, I'd met a few people who were doing contact improv, that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until I was 27 that I plucked up courage to go for an audition and study. So I, you know, it was another one of those moments where you kind of go, okay, I'm going to go on audition for a dance program. And there was me in my tracksuit and all these kind of young girls basically in their tights doing their jazz routines. And I was sitting there thinking, what have I done? What am I doing? So, but then another stroke of luck, one of the martial arts that I'd studied was a thing called Bagua, which is related to Tai Chi. And it's very, spiracular. It's very spiral based and swift and fast. And a friend who was a dancer helped me arrange some of that to a Stevie Winwood track. And so that's what I did for my audition. I just did that because I, you know, in the technique class, I was just like, I was hopeless. I just didn't know what was going on. and then I showed this stuff and the head of the department just loved it. She didn't know what it was. She'd never seen anything like it. And she was, she taught Humphrey technique. So there's lots of fall and recovery and that stuff. And in Bagua, you have these very high moments and then these kind of diving movements out of it. So she was just kind of fascinated. And so much to my surprise, I got a place to study dance.
Where did you go?
It was Middlesex Polytechnic when I went there. It's now Middlesex University.
Okay.
Yeah, so I did 3 years of kind of trying to find myself as a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I got really interested in choreography I came out of there. I did dance and fine arts. I was also interested. My mother was an artist, and that was another part of this journey, was to kind of rediscover the kind of the artistic side of my life in a way.
Was it visual art?
Yeah, she was. Visual art. So she had been a painter and she had lots of kind of strands, but she was kind of quite serious into her art. And so I then went and kind of started working with painting, and began to play around with the two things. And actually, when I graduated, I thought I was going to be a painter. I started showing and selling, and the dance stuff really was to buy paint. So any dance job I could get, I took to buy paint. You know, that was kind of it. But I got a residency at a spinal injuries unit. So there's a big artists in residence program in the UK, where this kind of bringing artists to work within the National Health System service. And so I went in, and it was a place called the Aspire Centre, which was a fairly new integrated rehabilitation centre in North London. And I watched the way this building was worked, which was, it was fully accessible. And it was used by people like the Great Britain basketball team, the wheelchair basketball team. And it was used by other basketball teams. And so there were disabled folk that used it, and there were non-disabled folk that used it. And there seemed to be no meeting, no place where these people connected, other than when it was being used during the day for therapeutic exercise, where the nurses would be and the occupational therapists would be working with people who were kind of in rehab, recovering from spinal injury. And then coincidentally, I met Celeste Dandecker, who was on the board of the charity of that of Aspire, the spinal injuries charity. And we got talking initially because she was also into visual art by that time. So she had trained and danced with London Contemporary Dance Theatre in the 70s. She'd had her accident when I was still just kind of beginning, I was off in America, kind of just beginning to see companies like Palobolus and just making contact with contact improv. But I was still, that was still really before I got into dance.
Yeah.
Celeste, on the other hand, had come through kind of serious dance training. She'd been one of the first kind of cohort of dancers to go through London Contemporary Dance School, and who were coming, and she was kind of one of the early dancers in London Contemporary Dance Theatre, LCDT. So LCDT was the European contemporary dance company.
Okay.
There were no others. That was it, because Bob Cohen had come across. Martha Graham had sent Bob Cohen across to the UK to establish a school. So Celeste had come through that school. She joined the company, and then she'd had her accident, and so which ostensibly ended her career. But it was quite. It was a long. Later that she and I met, it was in early 90s, and she was then working as a visual artist. I was there as a visual artist, but I'd also started teaching a Tai Chi class at the centre, And that was attended by disabled and non-disabled people. And Celeste came to that class. So we began this kind of dialogue, and which was about, I was kind of thinking, well, why don't we, you and I, go into the studio together and work? Because I thought there was more that we could do than the Tai Chi stuff. And that was the beginning. We did that, and then we were like, wow, there's a lot of stuff here. There's a lot of interesting material here. The most significant moment was this moment where I said, you know, can you take my weight on your lap? And she said, yeah. And so I kind of sat on her, basically. And I said, can you hold me like this? And she did. And this kind of, it was just this kind of moment of realization where you go, wow, we've just turned dance on its head. You've got a woman supporting a man, but more than that, you've got a disabled woman supporting a non-disabled man. And it was just like, we were like, okay, so we have to share this stuff. And we started teaching. And out of that, what was initially a 2-hour, once a week class, that was the beginning of Kanduko.
Oh, okay.
So we began to, you know, there were a bunch of people who came together and we started playing choreographically. We still kept the class going, but on weekends we would get together and play. So that was the beginning of Kanduko. That was how Kanduko emerged. Really kind of lucky coincidental meetings.
Oh my God.
And yeah.
That's amazing. And that was like in 1998 when Kanduko was.
Before.
1991.
Celeste and I met in 1990, maybe 91, 1990. Our first kind of trial stuff was at Middlesex. So I would book a studio and we'd go in and we'd work in the studio.
Wow.
So that's where it kind of began.
And then, but it took off very quickly, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. We started making work. We got invited in 1992. We got invited up to, so we were showing it in very small venues, you know, uh-huh. kind of informally. And then in 92, we got invited up to the Northern School of Contemporary Dance in Leeds, in the north of England, to do a residency and to make a piece, like to make a piece in a week. It's like kind of crazy, but that's, you know, that was the, it still kind of happens.
It does.
These kind of workshops, go and you make a piece. So we were working, and we took one finished piece and two unfinished pieces with us. So it was this just crazy venture where we went up, we had one piece in the bag, two pieces that weren't finished, which we completed during the evenings of that week. And during the day, we were working on this piece called Human Race, which was with undergraduates at the Northern School and local disabled folk who came together. And at the end of the week, we showed all that work. That was up in Leeds, you know, it's like a couple of hundred miles from London.
Mm-hmm.
We came back, you know, on the Monday after the, or Sunday or Monday after the showing, and then the phone started ringing. So there had been a I don't know why, but there had been a critic who came to watch the show, who wrote a review in one of the national papers, and suddenly we were being booked. So by the end of 92, we were touring the UK. By 93, we started touring internationally. First international tour was Denmark, I think. So Scandinavia.
Yay!
It just took off. So we were then touring internationally, and building the education work and bringing in choreographer, you know, high profile choreographers to work with the company. So there was this kind of huge melting pot that has never existed before. So the integrated work had always existed in a kind of, you know, separate kind of disability dance kind of thing, and we were very clear that we weren't really interested in that. that we wanted to bring the work into the mainstream. And then when, you know, then we got, you know, artists, you know, really, you know, kind of top up choreographers coming in and working with the company. And that also shook up everything because mm-hmm. that had never happened before. So there was this, particularly in the UK, there was this kind of spreading and sharing of that material, which led to the formation of lots of other small companies and some of them big companies now. But from the education work, so we always insisted that wherever we performed, we would teach. Mm-hmm. But we always did those things together. So we didn't want to get into that place of people going, oh, aren't they great? That's what they do. It was always, this is what we do, this is how we do it. So that kind of sense of show it, but teach it was always there.
Is it still that way with Kandugo?
I think the company, the company is in a moment of change now because the artistic directors have just changed. So, you know, all companies, change as the years go by. Mm-hmm. I think what has been happening with the company is that they've been doing rep-based workshops a lot.
Okay.
And that is, I think, to some degrees, that has proven problematic in certain areas. In other areas, it's great. They've kind of pushed ahead in this sense that contemporary dance is for everybody and that you can be a professional and that lots of people are coming in who would never have thought about it before, who would have probably always have moved towards Paralympic kind of work.
Oh, I see.
But who are now seeing contemporary dance as a valid kind of and challenging arena. But because of the virtuosity of a lot of their disabled dancers, the repertoire based workshops actually proved to a number of disabled people that I've met to be not very accessible. You win some, you lose some.
Yeah.
I don't know how they're going to continue in terms of the way they do their workshops. But I think you met Kevin. Kevin. So Kevin went to a Kanduka workshop and basically sat on the side for the whole workshop. He couldn't do it. So it's not to detract from what the company are accomplishing and the skill and the virtuosity of their performers. But when you do that, when you raise the bar in that way, of course, some people can't reach that bar.
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of, and yet, ironically, you know, when Celeste and I got together, that was absolutely our intention to raise the bar, that we wanted the work to be professional. Da, 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 da. So, I'm not pointing a finger of blame. I'm just kind of saying that when you go that route, you win some things mm-hmm. and you lose some things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it'll be interesting to see where the company, how the company shape their education work in the future under this new directorship.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me because you work with Kevin a lot still.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
That's an interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But I find, but also, you know, there are issues. One of the reasons why I left the company was because of, there are a number of reasons why I left the company, but one of them was I always argued that it would be fine for us at some point in the future to engage a dancer with a learning difficulty. And the company at that time didn't want to embrace that. And I understand why. Again, it's not a blame. Mm-hmm. I understand why the company didn't, because at that time, we were struggling still to say, look, we can be a professional company and what we're doing is not therapy.
Uh-huh.
So there was this big kind of push to establish the company. And it wasn't unusual for us to go out and do a workshop and somebody would pull up in a van and essentially dump a big group of kids with learning difficulties in the workshop, and you just would go, ah, no, that's not what we do. You know, you have to choose to do this work, and you have to have made a decision, you know, and you have to be able to understand, you know, what the work is about. So there was a resistance amongst the company at that time, but the company has still never employed a dancer with a learning difficulty. And I know some wonderful dancers with learning difficulties who, I have to say, are pushing the boundaries of what we think we know and what we think is possible in a way that, you know, really, really takes the work forward.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are dancers, for example, in Stopgap at the moment in the UK who are beautiful, beautiful dancers.
And actually also so you creating have to, their own work.
Yeah. Chris is making his own work now. Yeah. And Hannah is the most astonishingly beautiful dancer who can, do things that a lot of other dancers can't do. So there are these questions for me. You know, the company has, you know, is clearly putting some, continues to put limits mm-hmm. on who can and can't dance. You know, maybe, you know, it's just one of those things. Okay, so, you've really progressed this area, but what, but again, then there's this thing of people, well, maybe not everybody can do everything. But at that time, I felt I don't agree with that. And I understood why the company were kind of going in that direction. I completely understood it. And I wasn't about to kind of go, you're wrong. I just thought that's a choice. That's a choice that you're making, but it's not the choice that I'm making. So you're going to have to go that way, and I'm going to have to go a different way.
And you did. You started teaching all around the world.
Yeah.
And you went to South Africa and started another company that wasn't only integrated with different abilities, but also races.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I can't say their name.
That was a great time. Swarakano.
Thank you.
Swarakano. Yeah, that was a fabulous time and a fabulous project. And interestingly, quite amazingly, I was in Moscow a month ago at a festival there with Exim, with Kevin and those guys. And I walk into a cafe in Moscow and two of the Swarakano dancers, ex-Swarakano dancers, were in the cafe. It was great. That was a great experience and one of those projects that is, you know, was a privilege really to be involved in that. And again, about bringing together different communities and
you worked quite a bit in South Africa at some point, right?
Yeah. I worked with the Swarakano project, and then I went back and I worked with Remix mm-hmm. In Cape Town. And I made two pieces for Remix.
I actually worked with Remix as well in 2003.
Ah.
I feel like I actually, when I graduated from Laban, we were trying with my colleague to like find you. And I feel like we were like playing catch, like you would be in South Africa. We would go, you would leave. And we never managed to like get to your workshop. So, yeah, I they're a wonderful bunch of people.
Yeah.
And so then in 2002, you published Making an Entrance that has become my Bible, basically. And you write a lot about the work.
Yeah. The book was, I felt at that time, you know, we were, well, over the kind of, through the 90s, really,
mm-hmm.
we were going different places, and people kept saying, you know, oh, you should really, you know, is there anything written? Is there anything written on this? And the only stuff that was written was really kind of, it was either very academic stuff or or very outdated, very, very kind of old hat stuff. And it really felt like lots of people were saying, you should write something, you know, we want something that we can, you know, sit down and keep after workshops, you know. And it was an interesting time, and I felt like I had the enough kind of information to put something together. So that was a long, you know, that was before I was in academia. So I didn't know the first thing about, you know, how you go about writing a book or, you know, but I just kind of set to, really. And it was a labor of love, really, that book. And
I
it's
think
great.
It shows. And like all those little poems or proverbs or everything that is in like the beginning of the chapter is so beautiful and like ties everything together. I think it's very, very beautiful. It's practical. It's beautiful. It's a great book.
Thank you.
I think it's hard to write a book about dance because dance is so physical, but I think you nailed it very well.
Thank you, Silva.
You're welcome. You also worked with Lisa Simpson on the Simpson board that when I was researching more about you for this interview, I've never even heard, but it sounds amazing thing.
Mm. Funnily enough, I've just been doing a little bit more with that with Lisa.
Cool.
Yeah, I went up to Lancaster for a few days and did a load of stuff with her. That grew out of a series of workshops that we did at this special college, and Lisa was a student there, and who loved to dance but was profoundly disabled, couldn't speak, communicated through an eye indicator. I always felt when we did workshops that we would just kind of begin to get some level of communication and then we'd have to go. And I never, you know, I just was like, oh, I just want to find out how I access what she's thinking in a more efficient way. So the school were great. I said, look, I want to come again, but I don't want to teach a workshop. I want to do some research with Lisa and some of the other students. And they were really cool. And they said, yeah, that's great. Come and she, we watched her doing this artwork where she would select materials with her eyes and then indicate on a board where she wanted to place them. And that was what led to the notion of, well, okay, so we used that as a kind of initially as a way of her choreographing. So we said, well, look, if those stones were people, where would you move them? So we began working with her art as a way of mapping space. Mapping time. And then after a while we were like, yeah, this is fine, but it's really kind of Stone Age. so then we began to kind of go, what's the information that she needs in order to communicate? And that was how we began to kind of just think, what's the language? What's the language that we use when we're communicating? And we began to put that on a board. And the whole thing was, the idea was that we would do it on an eye indicator board, so a piece of card that just could be held and she could use, so it's cheap, you know. And this was like mid-90s, nobody had Apple Macs. It was just like, you know, well, some people did, but you know, they weren't ubiquitous.
Yeah.
So we were like how do we do this? And so we just refined down all the materials that she needed and kept working with it, going back, working with her. She would make work, we'd come back, and eventually got this thing which we called the Simpson board, so that she could choreograph and communicate the ideas that she had in her head to people that she worked with. And she then went on and formed her own little company where she goes out and she does the workshops, and then just recently she got back into touch with me and said, there's an issue, which is that when we're out working we often meet young people who can't read, and a lot of the information on the board is written. So there are words that word selections that you make, or you spell words out, or and so I went back up with her and we did a whole bit more research on creating images that would be effective so that somebody who can't spell can select an image which says something. And it might be just a, you know, it might be just an image of a person lying down, or an image of a person pulling, or an image of a person pushing, or, you know, so, but it was kind of figuring out how we pictorialize the information and still make it the board available so you could, so you can pick a person that's lying down and then show on the board where they're lying down. And, you know, all of those kind of, all of the gradations of, you know.
Oh, that is so cool. You know, there is a way of symbols called language of dance. I don't know if it's in UK, but it's here. It's, it was started in here in USA. And there are it's much more simple way of doing than lab annotation, for example, which to me is really difficult and complex process. But those symbols, oh my gosh, I was just thinking, those symbols, if you could somehow teach those symbols first and then just use the symbols, that would be, it is extremely accessible way. I want to order one of those Simpson boards and see that work, because it's really, really interesting. I used to teach in Austin in the highest special needs the school, and we would have a lot of kids who were nonverbal. And it would be so cool to have a board, dance board, for them to create dances in the class. So yeah. It's really intriguing and really, really fascinating idea. Really smart again. Adam, you're a genius! Well, and then in 2008, you went to academia.
Yeah, yeah. That was interesting.
Was that program accessible to all before you went, or did you sort of create it as well?
I influenced the program. I wasn't the head of department. Mm-hmm. I was there kind of really the lowest rung of academic. So I didn't want to go into. I kind of wanted to protect my my sense of myself as an artist and keep that connection to the world outside of the university. And I also, I have a bit of a deep suspicion of higher education and increasingly, and it's kind of why I left in the end, is that I don't think it treats people very well. But that's a whole other story.
It's a whole other podcast.
But. Once I was there, I was really interested in how we make the program open, and I got good support there. But the building that we had was really inaccessible, even though it was a new building. It only just opened, and its theatre was 100% inaccessible, embarrassingly so. So I set about making the university aware that it had shot itself in the foot, really, that it was presenting itself as this very kind of caring university with very good access. But in terms of its theatre arrangements, it was shockingly bad. And I did things like I made films about the access, and I did performances about the access, and all of which served to, if not embarrass the university, at least kind of highlight the problems. So that was all part of a campaign to get a theatre built, and the theatre that you were in over the summer last year, that was the kind of, the fruit of that campaign. You know, lots of other people working in different ways to make that happen. But I think there was a real, certainly the vice chancellor at the time came and saw the major production that Kevin was in when he was an undergraduate student. And she'd never seen integrated work. And once she'd seen that work, she was like, I didn't know we did this here. This is amazing. And I was able to kind of have a lot of conversations with her about, we would love to do more of this, but we can't because of the access issues. So there was this sudden shift once we got the VC on board, and she was really, really helpful in making the case for the house.
And now it is. It's completely accessible.
Yeah, it is.
It even has the bar that is in the wheelchair level. That was super cool. You can drink with your friends who are in wheelchair.
Yeah.
And now you left.
And now I left.
Like in December.
Yeah. I think I was just feeling that I was the thing about university is that it's increasingly monetarized. It's increasingly concerned with how many rather than the quality. And I was increasingly finding myself doing things that I have no interest in. And worse still, that I'm not very good at. That if I stay, just get worse doing the kind of things that I was being asked to do. So, you know, it's very frustrating when you can go off and you can do, you know, a workshop in Tokyo or Berlin, and then you come back and you're kind of teaching stuff that is not really what you do. And then you're spending excruciatingly long hours in front of a computer,
mm-hmm.
you know, marking and filling forms and just feeling like you're in a desk job. And I just thought, this isn't going to get any better.
Yeah.
We are so sucked into the computer now, and students spend, you know, when they're not at the computer screen typing, working, they're on their phones. You know, and I just find that it's a world that I needed to move away from, and to reclaim myself as a teacher, as an artist. So it was a bit scary because that was the first proper job I've ever had. you know, it, for most of us working in the arts, you know, to be in a place where, hey, you have, you know, guaranteed check comes in every month, you get paid, wow, you know, and you have paid holidays and sick pay and all of these things, you know, so it's a very, you know, it's a very attractive proposition, but I think in, you know, you have to know it comes at a price.
Yeah, well, you know, I just made that leap, 15 years of freelancer, and now I am part of a big team with that regular paycheck, but also having a hard time adjusting to the other part of getting the paycheck regularly. So, yeah, I can, that is, I know exactly how that feels. I'm learning a lot. I'm learning a lot.
Yeah. You meet some absolutely fantastic people and people who make you think in different ways, and you know, it's very rich in lots of ways, but the administrative kind of load and demands are just insane, and that it's, you know, it was quite normal for us as a staff team to be communicating with each other by email 2 o'clock in the morning. Nobody raise an eyebrow if you get an email at 2 o'clock in the morning. And that the quantity, you know, if I spent 2 hours in a studio, I would expect to come back to, you know, minimum 30 emails, all of which have to be replied to within 48 hours. And if you go off sick for a few days, then your email load just goes out. You know, it's insane.
It is insane. It's going insane. On. And, you know, I was just talking with a dance artist from Berlin, and he was talking about how time, the idea of time, has actually changed in our lifetime. Like, time as, like, you needing to be available is insane. And then time, in a way of, like, 24-hour clock, doesn't really matter anymore, which is also an insane idea.
Yeah.
But do you still keep on doing your artistic advisor work for the dance company? How do you say it? Kyo.
Yeah.
In Japan?
Yeah, I'm still. Yeah. So I'll probably be going out again next month to do a choreographic lab with them. Yeah. The Kyo grew out of, I've been working in Japan since about 1996, I think, was the first time I went out there, and I've been out there pretty much every year since then, usually I'm invited by a very determined and kind of solitary community dance worker called Yuko Ijichi, and she's a kind of a dance warrior. She just keeps going, you know, in the face of very little support, and it was her kind of dream to create a company, and she did that a few years back. The dancers are all part-time. You know, contemporary dance is has a very tenuous hold in Japan, even though, you know, we see wonderful contemporary Japanese contemporary dancers in Europe. You know, they're always amazing.
Yeah,
it's a big general, but they are often amazing. But in Japan, they have very little support. So Kyo, the dancers in Kyo, they work part time here and there, and they have jobs in other places, and they have no home base. The company doesn't have a base, but they are putting together, you know, new work every season. And I'm kind of there as a sounding board for them. And I go back every now and then, and I'll lead workshops. And obviously I made a piece for them a couple of years back as well.
And they definitely come across very professional.
Yeah.
I was kind of shocked to learn that they are not full-time dancers.
Yeah. No such thing.
Wow.
In Japan.
I was not aware of that at all. Do you feel like Europe is ahead in general in integrated dance?
Do I feel?
That Europe is ahead in the field of integrated dance.
Yeah, I think, well, it's really varied across Europe. So I think the UK, you know, although we appear to be going backwards politically.
All of us are.
Probably. Yeah.
I live in America. So as we,
yeah. It's just, we must appear like we're moving forward compared to year two.
Yes.
We're also moving back. But it's one of the few areas that I think the UK has been ahead of the rest of Europe with inclusive and integrated work. There have been, not just in dance, but in theatre, across the board, there's been a real growth of this work across the board, across the, you know. And then when you go to Europe, you'll find wonderful work, but it's often rather isolated.
Huh.
And so people are doing great things, but there is often not that kind of broad cultural understanding that if you go and see contemporary dance, you might well see a disabled performer. It's still, whoa, there's a disabled performer. Mm. It's like, it's quite unusual. But in the UK, in contemporary dance, well, it's kind of, you know, pretty much we kind of expect, and our contempt and the inclusive companies are well-known companies. They're not kind of an add-on. You know, Kantuko and Stopgap, for example, are embedded in the UK dance scene.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in the 90s, you know, we would sometimes, you know, there's a great example of, I think it was 93 when we performed at a big festival in Leicester, and we had the best audience figures in the festival. We were the top selling company, but they put us in the disability dance thing, and we were a separate thing in the back of the program. And they invited us back the next year, and I said, yeah, we'll come back, but on two conditions. Well, on one condition, really, that we are in your main program. I said, we outsold every other company. You want to somehow make us a separate thing that you place at the back of your program. So either you put us in the main program along with all the other companies, or we don't come.
Hmm.
And lo and behold, you know.
There
so
you
that,
were.
That sh- there we were. Surprise. But that's kind of expected. It's not, you know, there's no sense of, oh, it's this other thing in the UK. It's really there. But I think there's great work that happens in across Europe, but it feels far more isolated and far less culturally the norm in other countries.
Yeah, but I definitely feel like UK in general, like, think you were talking about in 70s having dance as part of your PE. You know, that is still a fight that US is having. Like, does dance even belong in, does PE even belong into a school?
Yeah.
So.
No, we should all be sitting at Apple Mac.
Exactly. All the time. So I think in that sense, UK is way ahead of the rest of the world. And I definitely felt it in your summer school, the way you were teaching. You know, we spend no time of talking about what kind of language should we use around people with disabilities. You know, we literally just danced and started dance improvisation. And we spend no time of separating people in chairs. You know, like you gave no time for that. And it's really refreshing. You just taught dance that was accessible to all.
Yeah.
That is still not happening here. And we were having huge conversations about language and what is the correct language. And it often ends up into very brutal fights and unpleasant conversations. So,
yeah, it's a really interesting one. And I think, you know, there have been those moments of various kind of different groups, disability groups, race-based groups, where you need that kind of separation and time to reflect on your own issues. But I think in terms of what this practice is, what inclusive dance is a practice where we come together. It's not about separating people out. It's finding, how do we come together as with all this difference and find a language that I think it's actually about creating through language an environment where we all feel accepted and that we can all participate.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that we use language is really important, but within a workshop setting, I don't think it should be the subject. And it's a real tough one to teach. You know, it's about creating an environment. It's not about a series of exercises, although also the exercises also need to be inclusive and participatory, without being dumbed down.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it was interesting to me to realize how much you have written about it and how little we talked about it. You know, like that was really, it was great because I enjoyed it a lot because I really would like to get to a point where we can just like use the word dance and that means, when it says dance for all, it literally means dance for all. It was, I definitely felt that in this last summer at your workshop. And you're going to keep on doing those at the university, though?
Yeah, if we can afford it, because now that I'm no longer there, we're being, you know, it's very expensive to hire that space. So we just about managed to afford it this year. Whether we can continue to, I don't know.
Okay.
It's, again, a monetization of the arts, and the university's trying to, it's a tough one. So we're there this year. Whether we're there next year, I don't know.
Okay. But your idea is to keep on doing the summer intensives, though.
Yeah.
Oh, those were fabulous.
Thank you.
It was so amazing. And what? When is it? In August 20th, right? August 20th to 26th.
Yeah.
I know this because I can't come.
I know, you're a bad girl.
I know. It looks like I am actually not able to go to Europe this summer at all. Also, part of not being a freelancer and having my own schedule, but my schedule being dictated by something else. That is important.
Yeah.
But it's just a change that I have to learn.
Yeah.
Is Exim, by the way, are you just guest choreographing or are you part of the company or?
No. The company's was founded by students that came out of the program at Plymouth.
Oh.
So it kind of, you know, I'm kind of like the granddad, but they made the company. That it's, you know, I have no input into the company in terms of its building. The students, graduates rather, made the company. They commissioned me to make a piece a couple of years back, and which was the piece that we recently took to Moscow.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And we're in a period again. We just did 4 weeks research, and Laura is applying for funding for the next part, which would be to make the next piece for them.
Oh, cool. How many people are in the company?
There are 5 dancers now.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And all graduates from the Plymouth?
No, this year we had an audition, And we had 150 applicants, which was cool. We narrowed that down to 16. And then we selected five dancers. So two are graduates. Kevin is one of them. And we got one dancer from the region, from the Southwest region. So kind of, and then two were overseas dancers, one from Austria and one from Belgium.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but a fabulous group, really fabulous.
What is Adam Benjamin's dream now?
Oh, there's a question. Well, there's lots, really.
Give me one or two.
One or two. Well, to make this new piece would be wonderful to make a new piece in, you know, with this company that has grown from students I've worked with over my time in HE. That would be lovely. I'm teaching a lot of Tai Chi at the moment.
Mm.
So to grow that in the region locally, you know, I teach in the village here, I teach in the nearby town, and I'm really enjoying teaching Tai Chi. So, you know, I'm not getting any younger. It's really nice to be doing really slow things with old people. So I have three very active sons, so I'm running around all the time. So, so that's, yeah. And I think to see the summer school kind of flourish, it would be great if we can continue to do it in this wonderful theatre that has been built specifically for access. So, you know, it would be great if we can continue to do that in the house at Plymouth. It would be, I just think, a terrible shame if we have to take it somewhere else because we can't afford to be there, you know. So the dream is that we carry on doing the summer school in the building that is, yeah, perfectly designed for that work.
So the additional comment that Adam emailed me later was in addition to the question of, like, what are your dreams? And this is what he wrote. My dream now is to develop my Tai Chi teaching in the Tamar Valley, particularly as I head into my 60s and spend more time working locally with companies and artists. It feels like Plymouth has grown fantastically in terms of dance, thanks in no small part to the wonderful June Gamble at Plymouth Dance. And I'd love for this rather remote city in the UK dance scene to continue to develop, hosting visiting artists, summer schools, and being an ever more vibrant centre for dance both nationally and internationally.